Well, it's a great pleasure to be here, I must say. So what I want to talk about today is glass surface transitions, which I think has the possibility to be different from what we're familiar with in a certain sense. And the sense is this: obviously, we know lots of examples of phase transitions where the transition is between a completely disordered phase on one side and an ordered phase on the other side. What I want to talk about is a situation where you replace the completely disordered phase with a phase or a state which in a sense has partial order and in fact has power law correlations. And this comes about if you think about some geometrically frustrated antiferromagnets which have highly degenerate ground states. And if you think about the ground state manifold and imagine averaging correlation functions, for example, over that ground state manifold, then you might guess at first that the degeneracy would just mean that correlations within those ground states were simply short range, but it turns out that's not the case. You have long range correlations, and this is something which is pretty well understood by now, but since it's the background for my talk, I want to spend about the first half describing that. And these correlations are called Coulomb correlations sometimes. So the question that I want to get onto in the second half of the talk is, what happens if you take this set of ground states in a frustrated magnet and apply some kind of perturbation which can, if it's sufficiently large, induce a phase transition. And the example I started to think about first, for experimental reasons which I'll sketch later on, is what happens when we have a random system, in fact, when we have small amplitude randomness in the strength of the bonds in the geometrically frustrated magnet. And in that case, you can imagine that there should be some kind of spin glass state induced by the disorder, and in fact that's what happens experimentally. And the question there is whether the transition to the spin glass state is different from a conventional spin glass transition out of an ordinary paramagnetic state. I don't have any definite conclusion on that, so what I also want to talk about is a rather simpler example of a phase transition without disorder, where we can push the analysis through essentially to the end and show, at least in that example of a clean system, that the fact that we're ordering out of this set of correlated ground states does give us critical behavior which is different from the standard critical behavior. Okay, so what I'm hoping...
Andrew, do you mean we should set fixed points?
Yes, yes. So what I want to do in the first half is summarize some of this background, and for people who know it very well, I apologize. But then in the second half, I'll get onto these examples of ordering transitions. So... frustrated magnets. What I want to do first of all is explain how this ground state degeneracy comes about, and then talk about these residual correlations in the ground state. So the kind of systems that I'm thinking about are n-component, are made up out of n-component classical spins. And, well, probably physically I'll be thinking mostly about Heisenberg spins. At any rate, I'm more interested in systems with continuous degrees of freedom, so n equal to 2 or bigger, rather than Ising systems. And then the frustration comes about because these spins are on a lattice of corner sharing units. So in general, you might think of units of Q spins. So if we were thinking about a two-dimensional lattice, those units might be triangles to produce the frustration. In three dimensions, you can build a lattice of corner-sharing tetrahedra, which is known as the pyroclore lattice. It's actually slightly simpler to think about some rather more artificial examples, and the concrete case which I'll talk about will mostly be a lattice of corner-sharing octahedra, and the nice thing there is that you can put the octahedra on the sides of a cubic lattice, and we all know what cubic lattices look like. So in any case, we'll have a Hamiltonian with some antiferromagnetic exchange and nearest neighbor interactions between the spins on these frustrated units. And then it's quite useful to rewrite that Hamiltonian as a sum over frustrated units, which I'll label by alpha, and then the square of the total spin on each of the frustrated units. And the point is that if we expand this square, then we get the interactions between all the pairs of spins in the unit plus the squares of the individual spins, which give us this constant. So it may be useful to give that total spin on the frustrated unit a name. And then the point is that this makes it easy to see what the ground states are. The ground states are the ones where the total spin of the frustrated units on every unit is zero. So for example, if we think of a single tetrahedron and four spins, and if we think of Heisenberg spins, then we can draw a ground state simply by taking an arrangement of four unit vectors chosen so that the resultant is zero. And if we think about the degrees of freedom within the ground state, then clearly we've got the degrees of freedom that we expect from global rotational symmetry. But the point is that we've also got some internal degrees of freedom because we can choose that angle, and we also don't have to form the ground state by having all four spins coplanar. We can rotate one pair of spins around this axis relative to the other. So we've got, in that example, two internal degrees of freedom. And the thing that's interesting about these frustrated magnets is that on a lattice, you have some finite fraction of the degrees of freedom in the system which are still active in the ground state. You have many ground states, and you can distort the spin configurations continuously to go from one to another. To emphasize that point, let me just sketch argument counting the number of degrees of freedom of the system in the ground state. So we can think about the degeneracy for a system of n of these corner sharing units. So if we ask for the total number of degrees of freedom in the system as a whole, then if we've got n units, each containing q spins, but if the units are corner sharing, each spin is shared between two units. So the total number of spins that we've got is n times q over 2. And then if they're n component spins of fixed length, the number of individual degrees of freedom is given by that combination.
What about the orientation of the plane as a whole?
Well, that I was counting as a global, as the degeneracy that we expect from the global rotational invariance, and so that it's not a surprise that that should be there. It's the internal degrees of freedom which are specific to the kind of problem we're thinking about. Okay, so the system as a whole has this many degrees of freedom. But we want to focus on the ground states, and to constrain the system to be in a ground state.
So what's the little m?
It's the number of spin components. To constrain the system to be in a ground state, it's clear from the second form of the Hamiltonian that what we have to do is constrain the total magnetization of each of these frustrated units to be zero. And so if we talk about the number of ground state constraints, there are capital N of these units, and we have to constrain all little n of the components to be zero. So that's the number of ground state constraints. And of course, really, these... This is quite a complicated problem because it's not linear, because the lengths of these spins are fixed. But if you assume that these constraints are all independent and can be all satisfied, then you can argue that the number of degrees of freedom in the ground state is the total number of degrees of freedom less the number of constraints that have to be satisfied. So you can say that the ground state degrees of freedom is the difference between these two, which is the number of units in the system into Q on 2 minus 1 minus Q on 2. So if we take Heisenberg spins on this pyroclore lattice made up out of corner-sharing tetrahedra, so Heisenberg spins means little n is 3, and tetrahedra means the number of spins in a unit Q is 4, then we get that this ground state number of degrees of freedom is simply n. And if I go to Q equals 6, the lattice of octahedra that I'm going to be talking about, then we have that F is the number of units in the system times 2n minus 3. So the point is that we can easily devise systems in which we have some finite fraction of the number of degrees of freedom in the ground state. Now, of course, these internal degrees of freedom are not there because of symmetry, so in some sense they're accidental degeneracies, and that means that they can easily be lifted. And even within the context of a classical statistical mechanics problem, one question is whether these degrees of whether these degeneracies are lifted by thermal fluctuations. And that's not something that I want to go into, except to say that you can show, if you look in detail, that provided that the number of components and the number of spins in these units is large enough, this degeneracy is not broken by thermal fluctuations, or at least not to the extent that the system orders at low temperatures. So we can have examples of these systems where at low temperatures, or in the low temperature limit, the system's essentially constrained to this set of ground states, but it can explore all of them. Then the next point will be to come on and talk about the nature of the ground states and the fact that there are, despite this large degeneracy, some residual correlations. But before I talk about that, maybe I should just be a bit more specific in terms of lattices and examples of these systems. So the idea is that we have a system made up out of these coordinate units, and it's useful to describe the different possible systems in a way that emphasizes that. So we can think of the units as occupying sites of one lattice, which, since you can call the units simplices, this is the simplex lattice. And that means that the spins sit at the midpoints of the bonds of the simplex lattice. And then the interactions between the spins run along bonds which are not part of the simplex lattice. They're part of another lattice, which is the medial lattice. So if we take a two-dimensional example where the simplex lattice is the honeycomb, so then the idea is that the frustrated units are going to be put on the sites of this lattice.
It's a face. It's not a simplex, right?
Let me get two steps further and then tell me whether the notation I'm using is wrong or not. So what I want to do is put spins on the midpoints of these bonds. And then these frustrated units I want to associate with the sites of this honeycomb lattice. And in this instance, the frustrated units will be triangles. So then the green lattice is the medial lattice, which is then the Kagame. Are you happy with that?
Yeah, so the triangle is a simplex. Let's have hexagon as well.
Sure, but it's the triangles which are supposed to be the simplices here. So the physical example, or some of the physical examples of these compounds, are on this pyrochlore lattice where the simplices are tetrahedra. Which I don't want to try and draw. Let me talk about another two-dimensional example, which will lead me to the three-dimensional case, which I'll think about as my three-dimensional system. So if we take the simplex lattice, this would have made things clear. So the simplex lattice, the lattice that I put the simplices on, I want to take to be the square lattice in this second example. So then I put bonds on the midpoints, and then I want interactions between all of the spins associated with a particular site of the simplex lattice. So that means I want interactions here, but it also means I want interactions like that, and the same thing for these four. And these four and so on. So this then gives a lattice which is sometimes called the checkerboard. And in 3D, there's an extension of this which is hopefully obvious, where I start with a simple cubic lattice and put spins on the bonds of that simple cubic lattice, which means that associated with each side of the simple cubic lattice I have an octahedron, and I have equal strength interactions between all the spins in the octahedron. And of course,
no exchange between pairs which are the same distance apart as ones that interact with.
That's right. So in that sense, the square example and the three-dimensional example are just theorist dreams. It's very unlikely that you could find a compound where you wouldn't have interactions between these pairs of spins that are the same distance apart, and it's also unlikely that you'd have equal strength interactions between this pair of spins, which are one distance apart, as between this pair, which are a different distance apart. But if you go to these other examples, the Kagame or in three dimensions the Paraclaw, then you are only asking for equal interactions between spins of a given separation, and so then it's more natural. So, okay, so in 3D I have corner sharing. Okay, so then I want to talk about ground state correlations. And there the point is that having realized that you've got some finite fraction of the total number of degrees of freedom in the system still able to fluctuate, even when the system is constrained to its ground state manifold, you might think that spin correlations would just be short-ranged. Actually, even in early neutron diffraction studies on some of these materials, it was clear that although there weren't any Bragg peaks in the diffraction pattern, there still did seem to be some surprisingly sharp structure. And the...
Are people thinking about these ground states as ensembles and the average over them, or in what sense do you have follow-up relations?
Yes. So basically, we want to think about averaging over those ground states. I mean, to define a measure on the ground states, what you really should do is think about the statistical mechanics at finite temperature and take the limit of low temperatures, and then you can ask whether the thermal fluctuations out of the ground state select particular ground states. This is what I tried to allude to briefly when I said that because these were accidental degeneracies, you could ask whether thermal fluctuations would lift them. So if you really look into that in detail, then you find that in some instances, basically if N and Q are large enough, then the degeneracy remains intact. And it's true that there still is the question of how you should average, what measure you should use to average over these ground states, and essentially what I'm going to talk about now gives you a suggestion.
Sorry, John.
Yeah.
How do you know the experiments are averaging over ground states?
Well, what the experiments are doing is looking at the behavior of the system at a temperature which is low compared with the scale of the interactions. Okay, so as far as these ground state correlations go, I want to first give a kind of quick argument that there should be something long-ranged in the correlations, and then talk about something much more detailed. So if we take one of these examples, for instance, take this checkerboard lattice, then you can see that there are some kinds of correlations which are long-range. So, for instance, suppose I take all the spins on this diagonal and I add up all the spins within this cigar that I've drawn, and the result will be some quantity m. Now, if the ground state's reasonably random, then you might think that this sum would be of order the square root of the number of sites which I've enclosed, but whatever it is, there's some result. If we think about doing the same thing on the next line of spins, then it turns out that the answer we must get will be perfectly correlated with the answer on the first diagonal, because every spin which enters here has partners which entered the first sum. And for instance, if I take these two spins together with those two, they form a frustrated unit, and the total spin of the frustrated unit is zero. So the sum on this diagonal plus the sum on this diagonal is the same as the sum over all the frustrated units enclosed between the two diagonals, which is zero. So that means that this sum should be minus m, and the same argument propagates right through the lattice. So we have these quantities which maybe only are of magnitude root n, but which are perfectly correlated in that direction. So from this you can conclude that there are some long-range correlations, and there's a more detailed way of thinking about those correlations, which was worked out partly by Isakov, Gregor, Messner and Sondi, and also by Chris Henley. And the idea is to introduce a coarse-grained description of the ground states, which has built into it this constraint that the total magnetization of each frustrated unit is zero. And in the coarse-grained description, the idea is that that constraint will map into a divergence-free constraint on a field that you introduce. So the idea is to find a way of solving the ground state constraint, and it's an approach which applies if the lattice that the simplices sit on is bipartite. So then the question is, what's the technicalities of how you introduce this field, which will turn out to be divergence-free in the ground states? And to do that, we want to introduce vectors which give the direction of the bonds of the simplex lattice from sites of the simplex lattice on one sublattice to the ones on the others. So we want to orient the bonds so we have a unit vector for bond I of the simplex lattice, which is directed from, say, sublattice A to sublattice B. So in the case of a lattice of corner-sharing octahedra, these bonds will be bonds on the simple cubic lattice, and they'll be directed from sites of one sublattice to sites of the other. And then the idea is that for each component of the spins, so if we have n component spins, we'll have n labels, which I'm calling A, we introduce a three component, because I'm thinking about three dimensions, a three component field, and these fields are defined on the bonds of the simplex lattice, and on a particular bond located at Ri, the field is given by, in magnitude, by the corresponding spin component, and in direction by these unit vectors. So then the ground state constraint.
Since the spins live on the middles of the bonds.
And that's the same place where these.
The field lives.
The field, yeah. And then the ground state constraint is that the total spin of each of these frustrated units is zero. And that translates immediately to saying that the total flux of this field, or rather each of these n fields, out of a given site of the simplex lattice is zero. So this ground state constraint translates in some coarse-grained way to saying that this is a divergence-free field. So then the guess for the weight on ground states is basically that once you coarse grain this field, if it has large values, there are relatively few ground states which correspond to that, because a large value of this field in a coarse-grained way means that the spins have all got to be aligned in roughly the same fashion. Whereas if you have a small value of this field, then there are more microscopic states available to the system. So you can argue that weight on the ground states can be given basically by the strength squared of the field. So there's some stiffness, which you don't get from this sort of approach, of course, and and so the idea is you have a weight like that combined with the ground state constraint that this field is divergence free. One thing that leads you to is a result for the correlation between spins averaged over ground states, and that turns out to have a dipolar form, so it basically falls off like 1 over r cubed, with something which depends on these labels should correspond to X, Y, and Z according to whether the spins are sitting on the bonds of the cubic lattice running in the X, Y, and Z directions, and then you have some angle dependent factors. Which look as you'd expect with dipole form. So in this paper, it's really given as a postulate, which is argued for in the way that I tried to summarize by saying that there are more microscopic states with small values of B, but then it's tested by comparing this result, or even a lattice version of this result, with computer simulations. And it does extremely well there. The other place where you can test it is by looking at the limit when the number of components is large, and so when n goes to infinity you can do the calculations explicitly, and again it comes out right.
What about, well, in one dimension lower, what's the power of the R? Is it just R squared then?
Yes. Yeah, it is.
Was eta
exponent
like one, essentially.
Yeah. Okay, so at that stage, basically, I've talked about the background which I wanted to introduce, and the main points are supposed to be that we have this set of very degenerate states, which are nevertheless different from completely disordered states because of these long-range correlations. And the questions now are going to be what happens if we turn on some extra interactions which are not included in this Hamiltonian, but which are much smaller in strength than this basic exchange, and use those extra interactions to induce a phase transition. And formally, what I want to do is take this main interaction off to infinity so that I really am constrained to these ground states, and then study behavior as a function of temperature, where I'm varying temperature on the scale of the extra interactions which I've added, which remain finite. Yeah.
In this sort of intuitive example you gave, it looks like the long-range correlation is constant. We have the m and minus m just going up.
But that's a correlation of a quantity which is got by integrating over this transverse direction.
So that's consistent with this.
It should be consistent. I mean, also these quantities which are correlated, I mean, probably they're not of order n. So in diffraction patterns, it gives you sharp features, but not Bragg peaks, not delta functions. Okay, so as I said, there are two examples of phase transitions which I want to talk about. Let me start off with the one in a random system.
Well, if I imagine going to finite temperature, will it just have grad b squared then?
No, if you go to finite temperature, if you go to finite temperature, then this condition is no longer satisfied.
That's what I'm saying, so you can put it a bit
ahead. Oh, sorry. I think you probably have to do more than that. So the point is that the ground states can be parameterized. So if you take some general configuration, you'd want to introduce a scalar potential as well as a vector potential to characterize the ground state. So you need some new degrees of freedom. Then probably at finite temperature, what you should do is integrate out those extra degrees of freedom and see what it introduces into the B action. And it really should give you correlations which decay exponentially. So I'm not sure if grad B would be enough to do that. Okay, so as the first example, I want to talk about transitions in a random system. And then let me mention at least briefly what the experimental motivation is. So there are quite a lot of examples of these systems, and one way to characterize them in an experiment is by measuring the inverse susceptibility as a function of temperature. And then, according to the Curie-Weiss law, what you'd expect is at least at high temperatures an inverse susceptibility that's linear in temperature with a negative intercept, which would be the Curie-Weiss constant proportional to the strength of the exchange interactions. So in an unfrustrated system, you'd have a transition at a temperature which was of order the modulus of the constant. And the striking thing about these geometrically frustrated ones is that they remain in the paramagnetic phase through and well below this temperature scale set by the interactions. In most systems, what happens at some low temperature is that there's some kind of transition which looks like a spin glass transition, in the sense that you see below the transition temperature a difference between the field cooled and the zero field cooled susceptibility. So the important thing is that if you compare the temperature scale for the transition with the one for the interactions, then this transition happens on a low temperature, and typical experimental values or maximum experimental values for this ratio are something like 100. So you really are in a regime where whatever's causing the freezing is some small perturbation on the main Hamiltonian that I was talking about up till now. So the question is, why this freezing? And, of course, it could be that there are different reasons for it in different materials. And you can think of all sorts of things which have been left out of the Hamiltonian, like dipolar interactions, single ion anisotropy, and some kinds of residual disorder. So one source of disorder would be random strains and then, if the strength of the exchange interaction depends on the bond length, random strains would mean that the interaction between a particular pair of spins is some average value, which is what's in the Hamiltonian I started with, together with a fluctuation. And so what I want to think about is a situation where these fluctuations have a scale delta which is much less than the main exchange. And there's a particular, what you might ideally like to do is take a material and vary the amplitude of the random strains and see what effect that has on this freezing temperature. And unfortunately, in most cases, that seems to be pretty difficult because essentially people make the materials as clean and as crystalline as they can. so it's not clear how to vary things. But there have been some experiments recently where by substituting one of the non-magnetic ions in the material with a different ion of the same valence but a different size, they had a rather dramatic effect on the freezing transition. So these are experiments on a material, zinc chromate, and the zinc was partially doped with cadmium, and even very low concentrations of that different sized ion promoted this transition to a frozen state. So I'm going to take that as motivation for thinking about the effect of weak bond randomness. Let me say a little bit about what that leads you to in this kind of language. So the main point is that if we think about strains, they lift the degeneracy so, for instance, if we go back for a moment to a realistic case of a lattice of corner-sharing tetrahedra, and we imagine that because of strain, these two bonds, which I've emphasized, are slightly stronger than the others, then, first of all, we want to think about ground state configurations where the total magnetization of the unit is zero. But then within that set of ground state configurations, we'd like to have these bond energies minimized, which we can do since they're antiferromagnetic by having spins anti-parallel across them, so that we prefer a configuration like that. And then to stay within the ground state of the whole system, we need that spin to be arranged like that. So the idea is that these modulations in the spin strength can generate some stiffness and pick out for individual tetrahedra preferred arrangements of the spins. And in terms of this description using a divergence-free field, a magnetic flux, this is a configuration in which flux is passing through this frustrated unit along a particular axis. And so if you try and build that kind of thing into this...
This unit does not have no internal degrees of freedom, that's correct. But you can have other configurations of this strong bonds, right?
Yes, and if you do that with the constraint that they're weak compared with the main interactions, then generically, what you pick out are these collinear states. I mean, it turns out that there are two parameters which are important. I mean, for instance, if you make all four bonds stronger, then that doesn't change things. So it turns out there's a two-parameter space you have to explore, and except at isolated transition line, well, except at transition lines, you pick one or another collinear state. Okay, so what you might guess as an effective description of the system then would be what we had before, and then something which reflects the fact that at different points in space we want this flux to run in different directions. So we can do that by having random vectors. And then if these are sufficiently large, you basically force the flux to condense into a particular pattern, and probably when that happens for stability, you'd need to add a fourth order term.
Is it n dependent?
Thanks. That's right, and it's so it's random in space, but it's the same for all components. Okay, so one thing which I've been doing is simulations. Not on this effective description, but on the original spin system. And they, I think, give a reasonably clear indication of a phase transition to some kind of spin glass state at a temperature which is proportional to delta. But what I'm not clear about at the moment is whether that's just a standard three-dimensional spin glass transition or whether it's something different.
Sorry, John, I'm
yes.
If I try to repeat this construction for neighboring corner sharing units, once it fits this direction, it looks like it will just propagate to the
side. Oh, sure. Yeah, which actually anticipates what I'm going to go on to. But the point is that which bonds it is in a tetrahedron or general frustrated unit that are stronger and which ones are weaker will, in this picture, vary randomly from place to place. So
most of these things will generate collinear patterns on a unit. So once a unit is fixed, you just go to the next unit, and that single spin that they share will generate the direction for you on the next unit. What's wrong with this circuit?
Yeah, but it'll be a different kind of collinear state, because it could be that it's this bond that's strong and this one that's weak, which would leave these two spins parallel instead of anti-parallel. So when you put these distorted units together, there's still some frustration.
It's Ising spin glass instead of...
Yes, yeah, there is a tendency to selecting an overall collinear state. Okay, so we have some simulation results on that problem, and I'd be pleased to discuss more with anyone who's got any ideas about whether it should or shouldn't be in the same universality class as standard spin glass transition. But what I want to finish up with is a different problem, a phase transition in a uniform system, where we can go, I think, to the end in discussing things analytically. Yeah. Yeah, certainly you can imagine introducing the same kinds of distortions here. I think what should happen is just that then B becomes more like a height field. I haven't really thought all that much about that, but there should be a 2D version. Okay, so that was phase transitions in random systems. So now, finally, in a uniform system. So to be specific, I want to think about corner sharing octahedra put on this simple cubic lattice, and I want to imagine straining the lattice in the 1-1-1 direction. And what I mean by that is that if I try and draw a particular site of the simple cubic lattice, so I have axes x, y, and z, and on the bonds of this lattice I have spins, and the octahedron is made by allowing interactions between all of these spins. Okay, that's something, not all of them, but most of them. Right, okay. So there is a point to this. What I want to do is, in a sense, compress the lattice along the 1-1-1 direction, and the idea is that that will make the spins, the interactions in this triangle and also in this triangle, weaker, or it'll make these bonds stronger compared with those. So these bonds which I've drawn in blue will have a strength J minus delta, and these bonds will have a strength J, for example, where delta is something positive. The spins which are coupled by weakened interactions will prefer to be parallel to each other, because some spins in the system have to be parallel, or at least can't all be anti-parallel, and then the spins in the other triangle will be mutually parallel but opposite to the ones in the first triangle. So that kind of distortion of the system will select a particular ground state, and what we want to think about is the limit when the main interaction goes off to infinity, and we think about the statistical mechanics as a function of temperature on the scale of this distortion. So then you can do two things. You can stick with the lattice model, and if you take the limit of the number of spin components off to infinity, then of course you can analyze that lattice model in complete detail. What I'll do instead is describe a continuum version of things in the spirit of this and that. So if we think about a continuum version, then we have an effective action, some stiffness, and now in the same way as I suggested here, the effect of straining the lattice will be that we prefer these magnetic fluxes to run in some directions rather than others. So, for example, this ground state spin configuration which I've drawn, if you follow through the mapping to the field B, corresponds to a field B running, in fact, in the 1-1-1 direction. So what we expect is that we'll have one stiffness for field components perpendicular to the 1-1-1 direction, and another stiffness for field components parallel to the 1-1-1 direction. And so if we give this a coefficient epsilon, then what we expect is that in field treatment, epsilon goes to zero at the transition, and outside mean field theory we want to vary epsilon from positive to negative values to take us through the transition. So in principle we can have higher gradient terms as well, so we could have a curl of B, then if we want to allow for the possibility of negative epsilon taking us into an ordered phase, to have stability we need to add some higher order terms, so we can have a term like that. And then, of course, the natural thing is to write the field in terms of vector potential. Then fix a gauge. So to begin with, at each point in space, obviously we have three components to the vector potential, but then fixing the gauge leaves us with two components. So we can think about the quadratic part of this effective action in terms of propagators for those two components. And when you get close to the transition, one of the components goes soft and the other one remains stiff. So we can think just about the critical mode. So if I say that the two components which are left after fixing the gauge are A1 and A2, and I'll take the critical mode to be just A1, then what you have is, if I go to momentum space, so this gives me Q parallel squared, and this gives me epsilon Q perpendicular squared, and then this term will give me a Q to the fourth, and those all multiply A1 of Q squared, and then we have the fourth order term, which I'll just write like that. And then finally, because the observables B all involve a power of Q, and because we've got a power of Q here, I think it makes sense to absorb that into the amplitude, so we can talk about a field phi of Q, which is Q times A of Q, and rewrite this in terms of the field phi. And so what that gives us is so then this term, once we've absorbed a factor of Q, gives us Q parallel squared over Q squared with, I'll take epsilon of it and put it into there, so I have 1 minus epsilon there, and then I have, once I've absorbed this factor of Q, I have an epsilon term, and then I have Q squared, and then I've got the fourth order term as well. So what I wind up with is a theory with a very anisotropic propagator, in fact a kind of singularity, non-analyticity as Q goes to zero, because it depends which direction I approach Q to zero from. So this is a problem which came up a long time ago in the context of the theory of ordering in ferroelectrics, and in fact Deemer together with Larkin studied this in 1969 and showed that this is a system. This non-analyticity of course corresponds to the long-range forces in the dielectric, so this is a system for which in three dimensions one's at the upper critical dimension, and so the critical behavior is basically mean field theory with logarithmic corrections. So the idea is that at least in this uniform system we have an example where ordering out of the correlated ground states of a frustrated magnet is different from ordering from a paramagnetic phase. Okay, so that's it. I think I'm really not sure at the moment. You don't mean quench disorder, you mean quantum fluctuations. One possibility is that you just add one more dimension, and so then you're above the critical dimension rather than at the critical dimension, and mean field theory would work.
My question is more about this on the
I think that would be a big jump. I don't know. I don't know.
These spins will be quantum spins. Mm-hmm. What's the sort of the temperature scale at which quantum effects would come in at?
Formally speaking, if S is large, you have a separation of scales. So the classical physics that I've been talking about, if we put the size of the spin back in, then the energy scale is J times S squared, whereas quantum effects depend on a energy scale J times S. So in principle, you have a window where temperature can be low enough that it's low in the sense that I was talking about, but not so low that quantum effects matter. Of course, in real materials, spin is probably three halves in the best cases, or five halves. And In those systems, maybe it's surprising that quantum effects are not more obviously prominent. I mean, the way that you expect quantum effects to come on the level of the kind of description I was giving is that the zero-point energy of these different ground states will be different. And so you can ask how much the zero-point energy varies, at least between different trial ground states. And there are a few examples which people have studied, and the scale for the zero-point energy is J times S, but the numerical coefficient in front of the variation seems to be surprisingly small. If you start from this kind of description, then I think a topological defect would have a core where this ground state constraint was not obeyed, and so at low temperatures they'd be prohibited. One kind of disorder you can think about rather than random strains is substitution of magnetic ions for non-magnetic ions. And actually, one of the striking things about the experiments, I deliberately didn't say very much, but they compare two types of substitution. One is substitution of non-magnetic ions of a different radius, which I argue introduces random strains. So that promotes freezing very effectively. The other kind of substitution which they make instead is of non-magnetic ions on the magnetic sites, and that seems to have very little effect at all. And you can understand that because well, you can, if you remove a single site, then you can still get the, remove a single spin, you can still have zero magnetization for the unit, and so you don't spoil this representation of the ground state constraint.
The non-magnetic ions typically play the role of ligands that, that promote the super exchange, and so in addition to the strains, they change the average J in the particular unit of the simplex.
Yes. Well, yeah, I mean, I guess the super exchange in this material, I guess the super exchange is through the oxygens and the substitution is at the zinc sites.
What makes you suggest that the phase transition might be different in that case?
Sorry, which case?
Kind of transition, I thought you meant from the Oregon state to the partially.
This, so, well, I mean, for the uniform system, it was this argument. So the point is that the effective description of the system you can reduce to something which, in a sense, has long-range interactions because of the non-analyticity here. And which has already been studied a long time in the past as a model for ferroelectrics, where, of course, you do have long-range interactions, which is why this term is here. So, so my point was just that one knows from previous work on this model that you're at the upper critical dimension in three dimensions, instead of having four as the upper critical dimension as you would do with short-range interactions. So it's in that sense that...
Are there any more questions? No? Good, let's thank John.